Good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Hopkins versus Hopkins. And sir, you are?
Brendan Brinninger.
Good morning to you, Mr. Brinninger.
Good morning to you as well. May I have a rebuttal, please? Thank you. My name, as I said, is Brendan Brinninger, and I represent the appellant in this matter. May it please the court, we're here to discuss a fairly unique situation regarding the application of Nebraska Revised Statute 43-29-33. I believe, after looking into this issue and the Court of Appeals opinion, there's basically only been one prior case to address this matter, and that involved a misdemeanor registering on the sex offender registry list. This particular case has us dealing with a felon who is spending time alone with a child of his now significant other in a case wherein she applied for a reduction of the biological father, my client's, parenting time. He, in the course of responding to that, found out that her new husband was registered as a sex offender and applied to have custody modified and changed to him.
What does the record tell us about when your client found out about that?
When my client was served with papers regarding the modification filed by the mother, it was for the purpose of reducing his parenting time to 1 weekend a month rather than two. He searched the internet. I believe he was looking for an address for his ex-wife and the kids, and searched the name of her new husband, and at that time it popped up on the sex offender registry list.
How long had his ex-wife been married to the new husband?
I cannot say for sure. A prior attorney in my firm handled this matter. After she took a new job, got to handle this matter on the petition for further review, so I am not sure about the exact amount of time. I know it was a couple of years before this matter came to trial that they were married. I know there was some discussion about the fact that the mother had not, in the record, visited with the father about the fact that her new husband was a sex offender. What we have here is a statute that creates a presumption. It says that because mother is married or is living with someone who is a registered sex offender and is a felon, spending time alone with the child, there is a presumption that there is significant risk. And that significant risk can be overcome by evidence. And what that implies is that it can be overcome.
It's not an irrebuttable presumption.
It is not. It can be overcome by evidence. It says so directly in the statute. And that implies that it can be overcome by evidence that there is not a significant risk presented by this gentleman that he will reoffend. The issue that we're here on is what evidence did the appellee offer at trial to rebut that presumption? Essentially, they offered evidence from four sides. They offered mom, they offered the minor girls, and they offered the sex offender himself. All of those are essentially not really relevant. The girls have very little to say about the matter. They love their father. They love their mom. They're kind of caught between two parents. Mom, she is on now her second relationship with a sex offender. Her previous relationship, that sex offender molested her oldest child, who isn't one of the two girls in question here. She's moved on to this guy. She minimized to her therapist the things that he had done, repeatedly molesting his prior stepdaughter, saying it had been the result of a bad divorce. So she's not really reliable evidence in this case. And then there's the registered sex offender himself, who his testimony was, I got counseling in prison, I'm fine now. What else would we expect him to say? So the only evidence that the court relied on in both the trial court and the Court of Appeals said great weight is placed on the evidence of counselor Joan Schwann. The problem is, she's not the counselor for the registered sex offender. Her evidence was, I only treat adults. or I only treat children. I do not treat adults. She was the girls' counselor. When asked about whether his minimizing of things to the new wife, keeping things like this from the girls, indicated anything about his likelihood to reoffend, his risk to reoffend, he said, I don't know. I've never met the man. I've never treated him. The only evidence that she presented to the trial court that she had about whether he was a risk to reoffend was information she'd gotten from Mom and the two girls in the course of their counseling by asking them things about whether he was asking them to keep his
secret. Was she testifying as an expert?
What's that?
Was she testifying as an expert?
It appears that she was. She offered opinions as to whether or not the girls had been abused, as to whether they were showing signs of things that she, as someone who is trained as an expert in child abuse, would recognize as grooming, things of that nature. But she gives no direct evidence about this gentleman and whether he's a risk to reoffend.
Did anybody object to her testifying as an expert or otherwise?
There were several objections throughout the course of her testimony. There was not, I believe, a specific Daubert challenge or anything of that nature made to her testimony. However, there were objections to many of the points that she brought up and many of the things that she said. But ultimately, I think the main thing the court should have latched on to was her testimony that I've never met this man. I can't attest to his risk to reoffend.
Now, well, was she testifying from any records of any type, medical records?
She had a few of her own notes that are exhibits as part of the record that she had taken from her meetings with the girls and their mother.
But nothing from prison officials or doctors?
I do not believe so. The sex offender himself testified with regard to what he had gone through as far as counseling there. We need some kind, given the legislature's position on this, the fact that they've recognized by creating this presumption that this is a serious issue and we need to protect kids, we need a rational test that we can use. Some kind of
standard. Well, what did the legislature do? Is this under 43-2933 sub C?
Yes, but there's no standard there. And
well,
the legislature...
Doesn't it say a presumption affecting the burden of producing evidence?
Yes, but it doesn't
say... What does that mean?
I don't know. It doesn't say how much evidence or what level of evidence. Now, we used to have a statutory scheme for assessing the level of risk of someone to reoffend. The Sex Offender Registry Act under 29.4.13 sub 2 sub B formerly had a list of characteristics to look through to assess the likelihood of reoffending. But that was repealed in 2009 when we went to basing length of registration on the offense you were committed for. However, there are a number of cases, Slansky versus Nebraska State Patrol, 268 Nebraska 360 is one of them that goes through it completely, that lists out a number of factors that should be assessed in whether someone's going to reoffend, whether their victim was a child, whether the prior abuse was repetitive, things like that. And that was based on, or that rubric was based on, research done by a PhD in the law psych department at UNL who had studied 1,300 sex offenders to come up with a scientific, reasonable, rational test to assess risk to reoffend. In this case, we don't have any such evidence. There's not enough here to support the contention by the trial court, from the Court of Appeals, that there is no risk, no significant risk for this gentleman to reoffend. Did
you put on any evidence?
I did not put on any evidence. I didn't try this case.
You did not, but did husband put on any evidence?
Yes, husband put on
ex-husband
evidence. However, you know, because of this, the burden shifts to wife to show that he's not a risk. And
is it to show that he's not a risk, or the burden to produce?
What's that?
Is the burden on the wife to show that he is not a risk, or is the burden on the wife to produce evidence? And does that make a difference?
The burden, as I read the statute, is on the wife to show that he is not a risk. I don't think that simply producing evidence is enough. There has to be some...
Well, the statute uses the term producing evidence.
Yes, the burden can be overcome by producing evidence, which I read to mean producing evidence that shows he's not.
Is our standard of review de novo?
I believe so, yes.
De novo for abuse of discretion?
Yes, I think so.
All right.
I see I've used all my time. Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Is it Mr. Vale?
Father, yes.
Mr. Vale, good morning to you.
Briefly, some of the court's questions regarding the record I may be able to perhaps clear up. First, Ms. Schwann did have the opportunity, and she testified that she did have the opportunity to review the records that Tom generated when he was incarcerated. We had provided those to her, and she testified that she could. Regarding the date that the two of them cohabitated, I believe it was May of 2010, and then shortly thereafter, just a couple of months, they married. And so by the time we're at trial, it was about 4 years that they had been either living together or in the world.
What records did she review?
I believe Tom's records of what he did in the Lincoln Correctional Institution, the services that were provided. Golf 1, 2, and 3, as well as his inpatient.
Any opinions in those records that he's not likely to reoffend?
I don't believe so, no. I don't think that would have come within the umbrella of what they were doing.
Was she a fact witness in your view or an expert?
Both. I think Ms. Schwann's testimony was heavily relied upon because she was providing continued contact with the children. She was a support for the children, as well as making sure that not only they felt safe, which is similar to what the Watkins Court seemed to indicate was important in the factors that they looked at, but also that we didn't see or she didn't see what normally may be occurring in terms of grooming or other types of red flags, and making sure that the boundaries that had been testified to and set up were being maintained and weren't just something that was hanging on the refrigerator and not followed. And so I think that she was an expert witness from the standpoint of the grooming and the red flags, but also a fact witness regarding the children's safety and how well they were doing.
Isn't it more important of what he might be or his frame of mind and where he is at his state of recovery?
More important. It's certainly important.
I mean, it'd be more helpful to us.
The statute itself does not identify what particular evidence the appellee needed to demonstrate that there wasn't a significant risk. Would it have been helpful in something that the court could be interested in or interested in? Yes. But the other issue is, at least on this record, we don't have anything in the record to indicate that we've got X as an assessment, and this assessment is going to give you some sort of percentage as to the reoffense rate or what he's going to do or not do in the future.
But they do have psychological testing that will give you that result, will they not?
I don't believe so. They have some that would be tools to assist the evaluator in making perhaps an educated judgment, similar to relapsing, and I think that's the term of art used even in sexual offenses. But I don't think that there is one test that we have or a banner of tests that will say he is very likely to reoffend or he isn't. And I believe what there is available is all self-report as well.
What does risk mean in the statute?
Significant risk. Or the word risk itself, I think, would be its plain and ordinary meaning, in that there is a chance that the children would fall some negative consequence.
So it's a risk to reoffend?
Yes.
Using the passive voice, they're going to stumble into being victims, but what that I don't think is necessarily tied to the language of the statute.
Okay. I'm not sure that I understand.
Risk to reoffend, is that the language of the statute?
No, it's not. It absolutely is not. Okay. I think that's the concern, is that some harm is going to befall them when we're talking about a significant risk, and if we're talking about a sexual offender, I'm assuming
so
that that's...
What's risk in, as used in the statute? Children at risk, or the risk of reoffense, or how do you read the meaning of the statute altogether?
Are you reading at risk of harm to the child?
Yes.
Let me ask you about the statute. Both sub 1A and sub B use pretty much the same language of no visitation for any time, unless the court finds that there is no significant risk to the child. Do you agree that the appellee in this case bore the burden of persuasion on the question of whether or not there was significant risk?
I approached this case at all times assuming that I had the risk of production and persuasion.
What do you base that on?
Trial court's indications to me. I mean, as a practical matter, as I was trying it, that's what I had assumed. I think I would have been ill-advised.
Well, if no evidence were offered, you wouldn't get visitation or custody, or you wouldn't have any right to the child. So you had to offer some evidence to overcome the presumption that... the children are at risk.
Right, I agree.
What do you think the statute says your burden is?
I think it is more likely than not, or a preponderance of the evidence, that there isn't a significant risk of harm to the children.
And do you think the statute says you have the burden of persuasion?
I think between the word unless and how provision C is worded, yes. I mean,
you have the initial burden.
I do have the initial burden,
and then what happens? If you're trying the case, and I am removed from trying cases, but if you're trying the case, you're making the assumption without an exposition of the statute that you need to put on as much as you can because you don't know how persuasion and burden and presumptions are going to shift, if any.
Right. That's absolutely right. I'm not going to convince a trial court judge that if there's any belief in their mind that there's a risk to this child, that I'm going to prevail. I'm just not going to do it. And so...
So in practical matter at the trial level, you'll put it all
out. To
me,
it's a distinction without a difference. I still am going to have to make sure that these kids are safe.
Thank you. Counsel, I want to back you up a little bit to the remarks you made about Schwann reviewing the Department of Correctional Services records.
Yes.
How did Dr. Schwann get those records?
I provided them.
All right, so you obtained them?
Yes.
And did you get treatment records only from the Department of Correctional Services, or did the records that she reviewed contain any risk assessment at all?
I don't know that the record itself is indicative of exactly what she reviewed. I wouldn't presume to testify before this body, but it is my recollection that there would have been no risk assessment. For sure. I don't know that that fell within that umbrella. And I don't know whether that would have been through the Gulf 3 program or potentially the inpatient program that he participated in for that 18 to 20.
Those records are not in our record.
I do not. No. No, they are not. No. Ms. Schwann simply testified that she had those available to her and did review those. And that's when she testified that she met with Kyle and decided she needed to take a stronger look at this, so to speak, or a more in-depth look at it. Some of the facts that I think that are important in terms of meeting that burden of proof, though, that were offered at trial include an array of information. For example, the behavior that caused Tom to be a sexual offender and on the registry occurred in 2002, and we tried this in 2014. So a significant length of time had occurred. The testimony was that he had had no law enforcement contacts, no contacts by Health and Human Services, that there were no authorities that had any issue with his behavior. The parents both agreed that the children were basically happy, healthy, well-adjusted children. Robert admitted that he had no qualms with Kyle's parenting. His major concern, as it came back around, was Tom. Tom testified convincingly and persuasively as to what he learned through that intensive program that was provided by the with a correctional institution. He testified that the inpatient program that he participated in, which I think is significant, was done even though he knew that he was not going to get released sooner. That was not going to affect him in any way, shape, or form. He did that solely because he wanted to change. We also have Mom's testimony that the boundaries were in place. We have Joan Schwann's constant contact or periodic contact with the children. There wasn't any contrary evidence other than the conviction that indicated that there was a risk.
I'd like to take you back to the statute one more time. What does the word significant in the phrase no significant risk, how would you characterize that? Because I think among the public at large, their expectation would be conviction, that's it. No visitation now or forever. What do you think the legislature meant?
I think the word significant has its plain and ordinary meaning and was chosen very specifically to mean a material or a fairly high chance at risk being present. More than just this isn't a strict liability. This isn't if you did this, then this. So theoretically, I can show at a trial court level that there was a risk or a small risk and still prevail.
Is a 10% risk enough to prevent visitation or custody?
I would not think 10% would be significant. No, I don't know. It's hard to put percentages on, but I don't think that would be constant.
Well, it's not defined. It has to be left to the discretion of the trial court.
Right, and the trial court heard and observed the witnesses. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Michael E. McLemore. The court will be joined by Judge Francie Reedman of the Court of Appeals for this case. And as a matter of fact, the court has been joined by Judge Francie Reedman. So my notes indicate